Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet and Ed Burnham, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
David, I'm doing better than Rudy Giuliani.
That's a low bar. It is, we're recording this on the afternoon of Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving to you, Frank, and to all of our listeners who celebrate Thanksgiving. Hope everyone is staying healthy and safe and enjoying Thanksgiving in this very unusual year.
And to you, David, and your family. And happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners. And if we're giving thanks, we should take a moment and acknowledge our listeners and thank them for listening.
Yes, yes. Thank you for indulging us and listening to our podcast and us ramble every week. Right. The bestseller right now, a book that I'm seeing in bookstores here in Edinburgh, is Barack Obama's new memoir, A Promised Land. Which is the first of, I think it's supposed to be two volumes on his presidency. It has been received rave reviews in a number of newspapers, and I imagine it's going to be under the Christmas tree in lots of households next month. But we thought we would take this episode to talk about presidential memoirs, what it is they do, what it is they don't do, what do they look like from the perspective of a historian.
I, in fact, have a copy of Obama's new book, David.
And have you read it?
Well, I have not. I've not been allowed to read it for the following reasons. So we bought it as a gift for somebody who lives for Christmas, who does not live in this country, but does not live in the United States either. So we were preparing to send this. And Mimi, who will be known to listeners of this podcast, went to the post office to send it. But the book is so heavy that it was going to be prohibitively expensive to send it. however, we're getting it sent from an online retailer, we hope, to this individual as a gift, in which case this will become our copy. But because we're not sure about that yet, because this country is not one where it's easy to send things by some of the online retailers that'll be well known to people, I'm not allowed to touch it because we still might need to send it as a gift. But I have held it in my hand and looked at it, and it's a very handsome book. It's very well it's very well made and very well, it looks like a presidential memoir should look.
And probably an appropriate gift for someone for the holidays. It is 768 pages, so it will provide lots of holiday joy for somebody.
It has Christmas present written all over it.
All over it, right, which may have something to do with the timing of its release. So let's talk about the history of these memoirs. They're obviously very commonplace in recent history. All the recent presidents have published one of these, some of them have published more than one memoirs. But when we go back to try to see sort of the early history of this, I guess they were far less common, in the early Republic. When would you think the first presidential memoir would be? Well, who we give credit for?
Well, that's a good question, David. I think we need to draw a distinction, and we'll get to this with some of the more famous ones in a moment. I think we need to draw a distinction between the first memoirs written by presidents or autobiographies written by presidents and the first presidential memoirs, which are different, as I'm about to make clear. So the first presidential autobiography, I guess it's a tie between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, each of whom wrote autobiographies late in life, tinkered with them late in life, and given that they died on the same day, I'm not sure there's anything to be gained by trying to see who was first. Jefferson wrote his mainly, the first version of his autobiography in 1819 and 20.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's really, really boring. It's possibly the most boring autobiography ever written by an interesting person. So Jefferson's life, now in fairness to Jefferson, he said, "The journal of my life are my letters." And if one reads Jefferson's correspondence, it's incredibly rich. But his autobiography, or what we now know as his autobiography, is an unbelievably hard slog. I don't know whether you've read it or even
I have not.
I'm really doing a good job of selling it to you, I can tell. Adams is more interesting. But as I recall, Adams kind of writes down to the American Revolution. He doesn't write about his presidency. And Jefferson writes about his life down to becoming Secretary of State in 1790 when he takes office as Secretary, or 1789, rather, when he takes office as Secretary of State. And the reason for that is Jefferson's, what we call Jefferson's autobiography, wasn't actually intended to be read as a freestanding thing. He compiled a three-volume collection of documents that he called the Anas, which is Latin for table talk. So this is basically Jefferson's gossip that he kept. He kept notes of a lot of the conversations he had while he was Secretary of State, particularly when he was jockeying for power and for position with Alexander Hamilton. He notes his conversations with Hamilton and Madison and Washington, etc. The Anas are really, really good and really worth reading, because they are as near as we get to contemporaneous accounts of what was going on in Washington's cabinet. And they're very bitchy in places. They're really good. And the what we call Jefferson's autobiography was written as an introduction to this set of documents that was subsequently taken apart by his editors after he died. And it took until the early 20th century to reassemble the Anas. And so what we read is Jefferson's autobiography wasn't really intended to be a freestanding document, and it doesn't read very well as one. It was meant to get us to the Secretaryship of State and then take it from there. And so it doesn't quite fit the bill, and it's not very interesting.
Oh, so what was, I mean, for both of them, these were not intended to be published during their lifetime, or were they, well, what was their intent?
I think their intent in both cases is to get right with the history of the Revolution, and both felt, because they both lived so long, they both lived until they died on the 4th of July, 1826. They felt that the history of the Revolution, that people were getting it wrong. And now each of them had a very different interpretation of what the Revolution was about, which is interesting in and of itself, and were kind of radically opposed in their interpretations. But they're both trying to get right with posterity in terms of, each of them and the revolutionary generation in general, but each of these two individuals in particular, Adams and Jefferson, are acutely aware and historically minded of posterity and their place in history and the importance of the Revolution. And they're trying to kind of get that history right, which is why in both cases they don't write about their presidencies. They don't think their presidencies are as important as the Revolution was. And so in that sense, the emphasis for both men is on the Revolution rather than their tenure as president. So in that, so strictly speaking, these aren't presidential memoirs. They're memoirs by men who were presidents.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Okay.
What do you think is the first presidential memoir?
It's one I mentioned, I think, in last week's episode, and that's James Buchanan's memoir, which he publishes in 1866, with the title of which is Mr. Buchanan's Administration on the Eve of the Rebellion.
And they love those kinds of titles in the 19th century.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Tell us about it, because I've not read it, I have to confess.
This is probably not one that I would recommend listeners read. It's an account of the final year, essentially, of his presidency. He publishes it in 1866. So he publishes it a year after the war has ended. And it's basically an effort to place the blame on secession on everybody except for him, and for the mistakes made during the secession crisis on various members of his cabinet. And he's publishing this book in the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination, and Lincoln has been somewhat deified. And Buchanan, who was very critical of Lincoln when Lincoln was alive, in his memoirs, tries to say, like, look, I was actually a lot like Lincoln, which is, it's not a particular, if you're trying to sort of understand that particular, the critical moments in secession, this book actually is helpful only if you're trying to sort of get at how Buchanan's trying to place blame on other people, because he doesn't take any responsibility himself. It reads as a kind of a very bitter book about a man who feels that people were criticizing him for things he didn't feel like he had done anything wrong. And I think actually that's a theme you're going to find in some of these other memoirs later, is it's about people sometimes settling scores years after the fact, trying to sort of frame their own place in history, potentially in a better place than what they deserve.
Well, and this is one of that to a certain extent, that's inherent in the genre, isn't it?
Because sure. Yeah.
Memoirs by definition are self-serving, and they're an effort to, spin history, if you will, from people who are, they're political.
Yeah, to be sure. That's without doubt a nature of the genre, although some of them are more self-serving than others. And some of them are, the ones I think are valuable, the ones where the person writing them admits mistakes of their own and sort of takes responsibility for the choices they made that didn't work out the way that they intended. Or where they realized they had misunderstood things and that all those kinds of memoirs, I think, are more valuable than the ones who are more Pollyannish in their readings.
So, David, probably the most famous 19th century memoir by a president,
yes,
and I deliberately haven't said presidential memoir, is Ulysses Grant's, are Ulysses Grant's memoirs, because there are two volumes, and Grant's memoir is still in print. It's widely regarded as arguably the best memoir written by a president. I think there's a reasonable case to make that claim. Can you tell us about Grant's memoir, both the content of it, what it covers, but also the conditions under which Grant produced it?
Sure. So Grant writes his memoirs at the very end of his life, when he is dying from cancer, The situation that he found himself in at the end of his life was that he had left the presidency and is in fairly solid financial position, but in a series of ill-informed choices and some bad choice of friends, he found himself basically on the verge of bankruptcy when he gets his sort of cancer diagnosis. And the memoirs were written in part, with the idea that he's going to not only sort of describe events of his life, but also have a financial support for his family after his death. And so he writes it somewhat frantically over a period of several months. He is supported in publishing it by Mark Twain, who he had befriended. And there's a very famous picture, which I'll include in the show notes, of Grant writing the memoir on a porch, and you can see him. He's wrapped up in blankets. He's clearly in a lot of pain. It's a memoir that people were paying attention to while he was writing it. I mean, there were accounts in newspapers of saying, President Grant walked, 3 miles today, and then wrote a couple of pages. It's a memoir that people were paying attention to as it was being constructed, in part because people knew how sick he was and were hoping that he would finish the memoir prior to his death. And of course, at this point, he was one of the most popular people in the country. It does not cover his presidency. It covers the first volume largely covers the Mexican War. The second volume is largely covers the Civil War. It would be great to have a memoir that covered his presidency. Obviously, we don't have that. There are some people who suggest, because of how well it's written, that Mark Twain may have had some editorial contributions to it, which is something that Twain denied. He said, "Look, I cleaned it up a bit after Grant died, but it was, my touch was very minor." I'm of the opinion that Grant wrote 99% of it, because I've read enough of Grant's writings, from his time during the war itself, that it seems like it's by the same pen. That's not necessarily the case, I think, for some of these later memoirs we're going to talk about, that where the person writing and the person whose memoirs it is are not necessarily the same person. It was an immediate bestseller. The publisher actually got Union veterans to go and wear their old uniforms and use that when they went to sell the book. And so it was, in terms of a means of helping his family stay solvent, was a wonderful success. And it's still a wonderful book and very useful to read. You know, one thing that some historians though point out is Grant, like everybody else, you know, is trying to shape his own history when he writes his memoirs. And there are particular places that some historians point to and say, actually, Grant's overemphasizing his role in this and underemphasizing this other person and is casting shade on somebody else that he doesn't like for some unknown reason. But it's a very well-written memoir, and it strikes me as one that's still definitely worth reading.
Is it? I mean, it's always rated as one of the best memoirs written by a president, often, as I said, mistakenly called a presidential memoir, and for reasons you've just explained, that's not the right way to describe it. Where does it rank among Civil War memoirs? Because, of course, in the 19th century, there was a huge kind of industry Civil War memoirs that were produced. I mean, first, I guess, two questions. Where does Grant's rank, and what would you say? This is a slight deviation from our topic, but what do you think the best Civil War memoirs are?
Oh, that's a really good question, because you know, this is an era in which writing one's memoirs was a thing that people did. You know, and if you're a historian of the Civil War and you're going back and trying to sort of reconstruct events, you know, odds are everybody involved in that event had a memoir if they lived long enough to write them.
Everybody who didn't get killed in the Civil War wrote a memoir, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, the one person who didn't was Robert E. Lee, and he was thinking about it, but he died in 1870. Grant's is definitely up there. I think if once they're sort of comparable to it in terms of style and approach, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain's The Passing of the Armies, I think is a really, really good one. Chamberlain, of course, is a college professor by background, so maybe that explains his writing, but he, you know, talks in particular about Gettysburg, where he was famous for his actions, the Little Round Top, all the way through Appomattox Courthouse. That would be those sort of the one I would put on par with Grant's. It's much shorter, which is an advantage. Frederick Douglass, you know, he wrote several versions of his memoirs, you know, the latter of which covers the Civil War era, and I would include that one, obviously. But yeah, there are lots of good Civil War memoirs that are worth reading. Thinking about presidential memoirs in the Civil War era, one that's probably not worth reading is it's the best Confederate presidential memoir, because it's the only Confederate presidential memoir. And that's Jefferson Davis's The Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government, which he publishes in 1881.
It's really long, isn't it?
Well, a lot of these guys wrote really long books. I mean, Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, also really wrote a really long, two-volume, awful history of the war / memoir.
But so Jefferson Davis. What's wrong with Davis's?
Well, it's a very much a defense of the Confederacy as a project, but it's also a defense of his own leadership of the Confederacy, and it's a memoir that sort of doesn't actually comport with what was going on 20 years previous when the war was going on. I mean, at one point, Davis says in his memoirs that, look, this is the war that would have happened even if there had been no slavery anywhere in the United States. That the war had nothing to do with slavery at all, which is something that would have surprised Jefferson Davis during the war itself. You know, and sort of as a book that's sort of trying to say that the Civil War was something about something other than slavery. You know, this is part of a whole genre of lost cause texts that that you know Davis is participating in. So yeah, I would definitely not read Jefferson Davis's memoirs unless you really have a need to. It's 1,500 pages.
So David, you cited, and again, we need to move back to presidential memoirs, but I'm interested. You mentioned Douglas, you mentioned Chamberlain, you mentioned Grant. What's the best Confederate memoir? Is it Company H by Sam Watkins?
Oh, the soldier ones are very good. Mary Boykin Chestnut's, diary, but she sort of planned it for publication, I think would also be up in there as a Confederate one that's worth reading. There's a memoir that is written by actually a person who studied at the University of Edinburgh. That's Richard Taylor's memoir, which is called Reconstruction and Rebellion. I might have the title wrong. But he was the son of President Zachary Taylor, who was a Confederate general. He writes this memoir about his experience as a Confederate general. It doesn't get read very much, but is actually one of the sort of more insightful ones, even if it's problematic in all the other ways you can imagine a Confederate memoir would be.
Well, just because it's problematic doesn't mean it's a value to, it's not a value to historians.
Quite oh yeah, honestly. No, thinking about, as a tech that's valuable to historians, I think that one compared to Jefferson Davis is actually useful for thinking about how decisions were made on the ground. I think, I'm hoping at the end of this, we can talk about sort of the value of all of these things, because I think some of them are valuable, but a lot of them are of sort of dubious historical value.
Yeah, so going back to presidential memoirs, we don't have very, apart from Buchanan's, as far as memoirs about the presidency, mm-hmm. we have to go to the 20th century after Buchanan, right?
Let me think about that. That's my impression, yes.
Yeah, and I have to confess, I have not read... Died. Well, yes. People who died can't complete their memoirs usually. But I haven't read Theodore Roosevelt's autobiography. Does he write about the presidency or just his time out west? And
I think he writes several books. Well, he writes a book about his, he writes a memoir that it's after the presidency, which I haven't read in many, many years.
Does he write about the presidency in that, or is he just write about
him? I don't remember, honestly.
His adventures in the Amazon and things like that.
He definitely, that's a good question. Listeners okay. Who've read that recently, let us know.
This is like an undergraduate tutorial. We're both going to talk about a book we haven't read.
Well, we didn't go back and reread 20,000 page presidential memoirs in preparation for this podcast.
No, we did not. So I'm confessing ignorance. I don't know whether Theodore Roosevelt he was a prodigious writer. He wrote a vast mm-hmm. amount of material, whether he wrote about his presidency or not. I simply don't know that. But the modern presidential memoir really begins with Truman after the Second World War, but what do we have in the early 20th century?
Well, it's one that I've heard that I also haven't read, again, speaking about books you haven't read, but gets good marks, surprisingly, from people who have, is Calvin Coolidge's autobiography, which was a bestseller in 1929. And it's a very short, as opposed to some of these other ones, this one is very short. It is something like 40,000 words. It's under 300 pages. So it's a very short autobiography. It's not a hugely insightful book in terms of trying to sort of make sense of the Coolidge administration, if one is trying to do that. But it was sort of written as a book to sort of inspire young men to leadership kind of text.
Moral teaching kind of tool?
Sort of autobiography as moral lesson, a bit like maybe sort of Ben Franklin's autobiography.
Oh, okay.
but supposedly it's very well written. So
do you think the appeal of that in the would have been okay because he's not Hoover? You know, 1929. If it appears in 1929, you know, the depression. We have the onset of the depression. Hoover is generally reckoned to be a failure. We've talked about Hoover in the past and whether that's justified or not. But one could imagine a sort of Coolidge nostalgia, maybe at that point.
Well, that would have been very early for any Coolidge nostalgia, because I mean, it comes out actually right after his presidency.
Right.
I don't know what point in the outbreak of the depression the book came out. But I think, you know, in terms of the modern version of all of these kinds of memoirs, it really does and sort of the tradition of being this being something that is expected in some ways of a former president. I think it starts with Truman.
Yeah, that's right. Because FDR dies in office, of course, and his memoirs would have been very interesting, but he did not live to see them, to publish them. Truman writes in the mid-50s a two-volume memoir, and this was a big deal when they came out, and they were bestsellers. I've read Truman's memoirs. They're not bad. And the first volume in particular, about that transition period, you know, from we talked about presidential transitions last week, his assumption of the office after the death of Roosevelt and the end of the First World War, and the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War. Very interesting stuff, actually. And I actually think Truman's memoirs, the second volume is a bit of a slog, but I can see why they became sort of Truman's memoirs are important because they establish presidential memoirs as a thing. And I think there's a reason for that. I think people thought, oh, this is of value. This is something worth doing. Now, he wrote them in part for money and in part to kind of establish his place in history, I think.
Yeah. I would. I mean, if you think about the context in which he leaves the White House, you know, he left with fairly low popularity ratings in 1953, you know, and so he's writing this in a context in which, you know, he's trying to sort of rehabilitate his own image. But he's also doing it for, I think this is probably the driving reason. He's doing this for financial reasons. He leaves the White House before there is a presidential pension. So the only income he has when he leaves the White House is the pension he has from serving in the First World War.
And he wasn't from a wealthy background.
No. He's considering, like, what's the right thing for me to do at this point? You know, he gets offers to work in Wall Street or something. But he doesn't think that's appropriately presidential to do that. And so sort of writing the memoirs is a sort of way of providing for, you know, his family in a life after politics.
He's also succeeded by somebody who's very popular in Eisenhower as well.
To be sure. Who also writes, you know, a series of memoirs after his presidency. And in fact, all the presidents afterwards who live long enough do. Which are the ones you think are the most interesting of this sort of long series of memoirs that we get?
Yes, I suppose, like presidential libraries, the presidential memoir becomes something former presidents are expected to do after Truman. And they've all done it.
And Truman's, I think that, like, that's a good connection, because I think those two elements rise to the fore at the same time.
You know, yeah, FDR, that's right.
FDR is the first presidential library, but obviously he doesn't write a memoir. But then Truman's is the next one. And, you know, that idea of here's a place where I'm preserving my legacy physically, but also here's a recording of how I want to be remembered, which may or may not have anything to do with what actually happened. But that sense of the presidency is something that deserves a public accounting of a sort.
Yes, and sort of obvious joking aside, President Trump has broken with so many presidential norms One wonders whether he will write a memoir or not, and if he does, what form it will take. On one hand, he claims to be a best-selling author because of The Art of the Deal and things like this, but we know, I mean, there's strong evidence that he did not write most of the books that are attributed to him.
No, he didn't write any of the books.
Okay, well, all right. Yes, okay.
Yeah, the guy who wrote Art of the Deal has said, like, you know, Trump was barely involved in writing.
Yes, yes. But anyway, it will be interesting to see whether Trump breaks this norm as well, because we have an unbroken streak going back to Truman of, as you say, every president who lived long enough to write a memoir wrote a memoir. And answer your questions to which of these I think are the most interesting. Maybe we'll go back and unpack these. I think Nixon's memoirs are interesting, and as an effort to rehabilitation. I think his first memoir, because he wrote two, didn't he? One that came out in 1978 in the immediate aftermath of Watergate. Nixon was not a stupid man, and he's a pretty good writer. So those memoirs, although long, I think are worth reading and are interesting if you're a student of politics, American politics in the 20th century. They are considerably shorter than Henry Kissinger's memoirs, his Secretary of State. Kissinger wrote like 4,000 pages of memoirs over three volumes of memory serves. But Nixon's memoirs, I think, are interesting and notable. Jimmy Carter has written several memoirs because he's so long lived and his post-presidency has been so long. But the memoir of his presidency, like his presidency, is relatively short, and it's kind of earnest and well. It's earnest and well-meaning, but not terribly interesting. I know you want to talk about Nixon's memoir, and I'll hand that over to you in a second. I think George H.W. Bush didn't write a formal memoir, but he did write a book called A World Transformed with Brent Scowcroft, who was his national security advisor. And they wrote that together. And it's really about the end of the Cold War and how they sought while in office to manage that. And I think it's a really good book and a really important book in many ways, and quite insightful, unlike many presidential memoirs, in part because it's not explicitly a presidential memoir or called as such, although I think that's what it is. The other thing that George H.W. Bush produced was a kind of collection of letters that he wrote, exchanged with constituents, which is very Bushian in terms of the first Bush. He was one who would say, I'm not going to write a memoir. That would be too self-aggrandizing, even while aggrandizing himself. But I think that book is really good. I think Bill Clinton's My Life is possibly one of the most boring books I've ever read. I couldn't get through it. And the interesting thing about that is, one of the things we've learned to do is to judge people by the books on their shelves during lockdown. Media figures and politicians, when you see them interviewed, I don't know what you do, David, but I always look at the books, freeze the screen, and then see what they've got. And for British politicos and journalists in particular, it's very, very common to see My Life on the shelf, regardless of whether they're Tories or Labour. I mean, this is or whether working journalists. So this is a book clearly they all bought. Whether they read it or not, I don't know. I suspect, though, that Barack Obama's volume is going to nudge My Life by Bill Clinton off those shelves, either literally or figuratively. So I think Bill Clinton's memoir was, like Bill Clinton, verbose, and there was just too much of it. So I did love Bill Clinton's. Our former colleague, Owen Dudley Edwards, who's retired for several years now, but Owen is a kind of student of prose, and he argues that the two greatest prose stylists to serve as president were Thomas Jefferson and Barack Obama. I think there's something to be said for that. Obama, it has been observed in the past week, has written, this is his third memoir, and once the second volume of this comes out, he will have written four volumes of memoirs. The first, about his, Dreams of My Father, is a fantastic book. And it's not a political memoir at all. I mean, it's a great book. And Obama can really write, which is why I'm looking forward, when I'm finally allowed to read it, reading his new memoir. So I'm excited about that. So those are the ones I would highlight, I guess. I think Nixon's is notable. Nixon's memoirs are notable. I think that the book that George H.W. Bush wrote with Brent Scowcroft is really good and really interesting and important as somebody who's a student of international relations. And I think Obama's will be really good based on his track record. What about you?
Well, I was just thinking about, you're mentioning the George H.W. Bush one. I think that's indicative about his presidency, that he wanted to talk about foreign policy and not about domestic policy, because
that's right.
His domestic policy didn't go very well.
And he wasn't interested.
I think that was, his interest before he was president. His interest during his presidency was definitely.
But that transitional moment at the end of the Cold War is really, really important in international relations. And therefore, his insight into that is very valuable, I think.
I would agree. The thing about some of these texts, you always sort of wonder about how much of them, the person who is writing them is the president, how much of them is not. Some of these presidents are, as you point out, very gifted writers, and some of them are otherwise. Lyndon Johnson, for instance, had a whole team of people helping him write his memoirs. And supposedly they recorded lots of interviews with him, and Johnson was a very famous storyteller. And then they'd write down all the good stories, and he'd say, "No, cut that out. That doesn't sound presidential." And so what you were left with was all the sort of bits between the good stories, which don't really add up to very much. In terms of a text that's a hard text to parse as a historian, obviously Nixon's is up there, because I think Nixon did have a very heavy hand in actually writing his memoirs as opposed to Johnson. But Nixon is very much trying to shape his, rehabilitate his own image. You see that both in his first memoirs and his second memoirs, where he's trying to sort of justify the actions of his presidency in his first memoirs, and then the second memoirs trying to position himself as a sort of senior statesman role, despite the Watergate and everything else that went along with it. One of the more interesting memoirs, though, is Reagan's. I don't know whether you've ever read Reagan's memoirs. It's called An American Life, which is published in 1990. And this is one of those memoirs where it's clear Reagan actually didn't write it. In fact, he joked when on the press release day, he said something along the lines of, "I hear it's a terrific book. One of these days, I'm going to read it."
It's a very Reagan-esque joke, isn't it?
So it was written by Robert Lindsay, who was a New York Times reporter, I believe. And the interesting thing about this memoir is it's both the things he includes and the things he leaves out. For instance, he mentions his first wife, and Reagan was married twice. His first wife, who he was married to for a fairly decent amount of time, with whom he had two children, he devotes a total of three sentences to her and their entire marriage, which is interesting. In terms of politics, he completely omits the Robert Bork nomination to the Supreme Court, which is one of, when we teach about the Reagan administration, that's one of the probably in the top 10 things we would talk about in terms of important political developments in Reagan's presidency. Doesn't mention it at all. In fact, there were lots of prominent figures in the Reagan White House that don't appear at all in the book. Talks about Nancy a lot, which is what you'd expect. But there's other events in this narrative which, when you actually sort of dig into them, don't actually make a whole lot of sense. For instance, there's a scene in Reagan's memoirs where this is in Reykjavik at the summit with Gorbachev, where he goes and he says, "Look, Gorbachev and I went down to the Springhouse and the two of us talked about things man to man," which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because Reagan doesn't speak Russian and Gorbachev doesn't speak English. So it was unclear exactly how the two of them were going to be alone man to man to speak about nuclear disarmament or what have you. So it's a book that sort of by its omissions and its inclusions tells you a great deal. And obviously Reagan in 1990 you know, his mental capacity at that point was in doubt.
Well, that's it. I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, when you say bits of it don't make sense, there may be an explanation for that.
But, oh, to be sure.
I mean, I always thought several years later, I think Douglas Brinkley edited it, and I could be wrong about that. Reagan's presidential diaries were published, or a published version of Reagan's presidential. And I have read those, and they're quite interesting, and he's pretty insightful, assuming those are legitimate. And, of course, diaries are more valuable than memoirs, but I think because they're contemporaneous records. This is where Jefferson's Anas are more valuable than his autobiography. So Reagan's diaries do suggest that, you know, he's a pretty sophisticated political thinker, even if he's not the most engaged in the day-to-day operation of his administration. But the memoir, I mean, I didn't read it, but the reviews more or less suggest what you've suggested, that it's of perhaps dubious value, but it's an interesting document, I suppose.
Yeah, Maureen Dowd in the New York Times just wrote a blistering review of it when it came out, sort of highlighting the various flaws in it. It's a wonderful sort of takedown of the both this particular memoir and the genre. You know, some of these late 20th century ones are pretty bad. Gerald Ford's A Time to Heal is pretty bad. The fact that Betty Ford also had a memoir that came out about the same time, and hers sold a lot better than his did. I think she sort of teased him for that. You know, in fact, the First Lady memoir has also become sort of a de facto event, you know, that sort of one expects to get along with the presidential memoir.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton's is better than Bill's. Well, Hillary wrote twice, too, because she wrote a kind of post-presidential memoir, which I think includes her Senate time, if memory serves. And then, of course, she wrote one after the 2016 election, you know, what happened. But I think Hillary's memoirs are more interesting and better written than Bill's are.
And Nancy Reagan's might be more insightful than, I don't know. Michelle Obama's memoirs are, which I have read, are really, really good and are insightful.
I have not read it yet. I am closely related to somebody who read Michelle Obama's memoir and was very disappointed.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But we can interview that individual at another time, and she can make her own case.
Okay.
But yeah, but so I can't comment because I haven't got around to reading it yet.
But I think, you know, one wonders, you know, these books are written when you don't know how many of these books are actually read. You know, I think the Bill Clinton example is a good one. Lots of people bought that book, but lots of people didn't read that book. I know somebody who was actually given a copy of that book by Bill Clinton himself and didn't read it. What is the value for us as historians of these books? Are they useful sources? Are they simply the former presidents trying to sort of spin themselves for history and should be sort of put in a box and largely ignored? Like, how do we process these in terms of our hierarchy of sources we should trust?
Well, I think both and. I mean, in the sense that, I mean, we're trained to read sources critically. Mm-hmm. Memoirs, by definition, are generally self-serving in some way, shape, or form. On the other hand, to get an individual's perspective, particularly an individual who's been in the role that modern presidents have on their reflections on what that experience was like, seems to me to be invaluable, even if one has to be critical. Having said that, these individuals vary in their honesty, both to themselves and to us. They vary in their ability as writers, and we've kind of indicated that. I have pretty high hopes for Obama's memoirs because I think he's both a good writer and I think he's pretty honest in considering his own time in office, given what I've heard him, you know, given what I've heard him say about that. But I don't know whether that will be so or not. We'll have to wait and see. I think, you know, Nixon's are interesting because it's an attempt for his attempt to rehabilitate himself. I mean, to some extent, the memoirs of rogues are more interesting than the memoirs of saints, right? Yeah. So Nixon's memoirs, if Trump were to produce an honest memoir of his time in the White House, that would be an interesting book to read. But I think that they vary because they vary in quality and they vary in honesty. I don't think one can make a kind of blanket statement, you know, that these are high value or they're of no value. I think they're of variable value depending on the content and the quality. I do think contemporaneous records are more valuable. I think letters, diaries, and so on that are immediately contemporaneous are of greater value. Having said that, modern presidents certainly are well aware of their place in history and are curating their place in history almost from day one. From the time they're inaugurated. And so we never get a truly honest account. In many respects, and we've talked about this before because we talked about the kind of accounts of people who serve in administrations, the memoirs and firsthand accounts of people who serve in presidential administrations, especially the White House, I think are usually of greater value than the memoirs written by the actual occupant of the office. Not always.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't read Obama's book, and I'm not sure that I will, but the press accounts I've read of it, the reviews I've read of it, don't seem to indicate there's much in the book that we didn't already know, right? I think that may be a value for people who didn't live through the path, that lived through the 8 years he was in the White House. I mean, the one part that everyone is mentioning is that he admits to reading books to try to pick up women when he was in college, which didn't seem to work.
Right, and that doesn't really give much insight into his presidency.
No, it does not. It gives insight to his failures of his dating life in college, which is interesting but not important.
But David, that's a good point. The point you've made is actually quite interesting. So maybe it won't tell us anything we didn't know, but. In the not too distant future, we know this from teaching young people, there will be people who don't remember Barack Obama's presidency.
Oh, to be sure.
And so they may find more value in this than we do as people who live through it and were kind of cognizant and following the news closely during those years. And so they perhaps do serve that purpose. I mean, I am interested to think about the kind of continuity between Truman's memoirs, especially that first volume about the beginning of the Cold War, and George H.W. Bush's co-authored book with Brent Scowcroft on the end of the Cold War, because read together, those books really offer insights. And now the Cold War is over, that period in history is over, but students of that period will find both of those books valuable in ways that maybe contemporaries, in 1994, or I don't know when the Bush book came out, but in 95 96, sometime in the few years after that, you might have thought, I knew that. What, there's nothing new here. It's actually quite a valuable account now for students of the Cold War. So Obama's book, to take your point, I mean, I think you've just made a really insightful comment.
It came out in 1998.
Right, okay, thank you. Obama's book might increase in value, in its value to historians, if it's an honest account in ways that we don't expect.
I think its value, and I think the value of most of these things, is less in trying to actually understand their presidency and more about how these people wanted themselves to be seen.
Right, sure.
Because I think you can read them very straightforward way. This is what Obama wants us to remember about his presidency, even if those aren't the things we want to remember. You know, when we think about Bill Clinton's book, the way he deals with Monica Lewinsky in that book is he's not particularly fair or honest to her. But that's the way he wants that event to be remembered. Reagan.
I didn't even get that far. I gave up when he was a chubby kid playing the saxophone in school.
and likewise, the Reagan's when he's not talking about Robert Bork. I think he just doesn't want us to remember that. He's trying to sort of buy its absence. But I think that tells us much more about what they want their memory to be, like presidential libraries, the fact that they, you know, do you include or do you not include these episodes? And what is it that you highlight as the contributions of your time in office? But you know, that they are fundamentally, you know, going back to Jefferson Davis's ones, you know, the kinds of fictions they're like most memoirs, they're creative nonfiction in some ways.
Do you think we will get a Trump memoir?
I think there will be a memoir which is published soon.
Attributed to Trump.
That Trump will claim that he wrote, that he will get a big, well, there's actually a debate, I think, going on now in publishing houses in New York City about whether they want to publish a Trump memoir or not, because I think, you know, I think there's certain people within the publishing industry who would say, yes, of course we do, because it's going to sell us a lot of books.
70 million people voted for him.
And I think there's other people who say, no, we don't want to be a conduit for whatever kind of misinformation it will be, undoubtedly part of that memoir. And you don't think, you know, so there's, I think that's debate's happening right now. I'm betting that somebody will publish a memoir, which has Trump's name on it, because of course they will. And all the people who didn't get Barack Obama's memoir this year for Christmas will get Trump's memoir next year for Christmas.
Well, I don't think they're I think the Venn diagram of those two groups does not intersect.
Yes, that's my point.
That's right.
The red American, blue America Christmas present list.
One thing I would say vis-a-vis Bill Clinton, that Taylor Branch, the great historian of the civil rights era, among other things, did a series of interviews with Bill Clinton in preparation for a biography that he never wrote. I think it was going to be an authorized biography. And they were published, I think, as the Clinton tapes. Hmm. And those are very interesting because Bill Clinton is not a stupid man. He's got a lot of interesting things to say. He is a bit of a raconteur. He likes to talk to people and he's quite gregarious. And I think he opened up to Branch. And I think I have read parts of that book. And I think that Taylor Branch's the kind of transcripts of his interviews with Clinton are far more interesting than Bill Clinton's memoirs. It's kind of akin to what you described in terms of LBJ, you know, and the production of LBJ's memoirs. But anyway, we look forward to seeing what happens, I guess.
Yes. Yes. And you'll finally get to read this memoir once you, Christmas holidays are over. Right. I guess it's time for last drops, Frank. What do you got?
I want to recommend a podcast, David.
A podcast, okay.
Yes, because I assume the people listening to this listen to podcasts.
That seems like a reasonable supposition.
It's called The Golden Age of Baseball with Eddie Robinson. Eddie Robinson is the oldest living person who played Major League Baseball. He turns 100 years old in a few weeks' time, I think on December 14th or 15th. So in a couple of weeks' time, he will turn 100. Eddie Robinson had a 15-year major league career in the 1940s and 50s. He was a first baseman for a number of teams. I think he hit 172 home runs. He was the first baseman on the 1948 Cleveland team that won the World Series, the last Cleveland team to win. He played in the Navy World Series in 1943. He's the last surviving member of that series against people like Joe DiMaggio. I think he played with Joe DiMaggio in that series. So he had an interesting major league career. He's an incredibly good storyteller. He's very, very sharp. It sounds patronizing to talk about old people complimenting them for being sharp, but he's clearly kept his faculties about him and has a lot to say. Great eye for detail. And the podcast is wonderful. And it's not even, I played with so-and-so and he was really famous. It's the throwaway stuff about, you know, going to see Gone with the Wind in 1939 in the cinema with a minor leaguer nobody remembers now or things like this. Very, very good podcast. Very interesting podcast. It's oral history. Do you know the book, The Glory of Their Times?
Yes.
By Lawrence Ritter. It's a great history of baseball in the early 20th century. Mm. And Ritter did a number of interviews in the 60s. So it's an oral history book. The podcast reminds me a little, it's a later period, but reminds me a little bit of that. It's not, I mean, if you're interested in baseball, you'll like it, but just to hear somebody remember, it's kind of an oral history of the and cultural history of the mid 20th century. And the guy's 100 years old. He's doing a podcast. We ought to give him a plug.
Exactly. Okay.
So Eddie, the Golden Age of Baseball with Eddie Robinson. That's my plug.
Wonderful.
It's a podcast. Okay. Yeah. What about you?
Since today is Thanksgiving, there's a tradition in my household of playing Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant on repeat in preparation of Thanksgiving meals. The song's about a half hour long, so that means I play it like four times or something. I want to wish a happy retirement to Arlo Guthrie. He has had some health issues recently, including a stroke last year on Thanksgiving. But he announced his retirement about a month ago, that he was going to stop touring. He had been basically on tour for the past 50 years in some ways. He's going to retire, and I hope he has an excellent retirement and a wonderful Thanksgiving. And everyone should go and listen to Alice's Restaurant, because that's arguably the best Thanksgiving song out there, even if it's only partially about Thanksgiving.
Yes. Well, there aren't a whole lot of songs about Thanksgiving, in fact.
No, the Thanksgiving has a paucity of good songs. So.
Yes.
But Alice's Restaurant it is.
Well, to Arlo Guthrie and to Eddie Robinson.
Exactly.
And cheers to all our listeners. Exactly. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.